tonight. When Bill selected me for chairman of this meeting, he let me pick two of my close friends to be on the program. This next gentleman didn't used to be calling him a gentleman. He's a tough Irish cop. I've known him 7 or 8 years. I've worked with him in AA. And they don't come any better. When the chips are down, they call on Jimmy. He's worked with those dingbats so long, his wife says he acts like one of them at times. So sometimes we call him Dingbat Jimmy. Without any more, I'll give him to you. Here he is. Jimmy Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure happy to be here. You know, I feel kind of proud that they asked Claire and I to come down and talk to you folks. Because it hasn't been too many years ago. But when people see me coming, they cross the street. They didn't want no part of me. So I put the great pleasure to be down here. You know, I'm not no expert on AA. Because X means a has-been, and spurt means a small drip under pressure. You know, I got a little story here to tell about Russ. When Russ first went up to Granby, you know, he used to be a sign painter, a drunken sign painter. You know, now he's the bank president. But there was a couple of young doctors moved into Granby, and office space was very hard to get. So they called on his sign painter, and they said to him, "We'd like to have you fix a sign up and put it up in this little office building in the doorway," and they wanted to combine psychiatrists and proctologists. So being an alcoholic, he didn't know what to do, so he bought a jug. So he came back in a few days, and he has doctors Brown and Smith and Nuts and Butts. So they said... So they were very displeased and didn't want to make him angry. So they said, "Russ, that isn't going to do." And they said, "You go ahead and take it out and you make another one." So he went and got another jug and he pondered over for a long time. And pretty soon he came back and he handed him the sign. And on it says, "Doctors Brown and Smith, Queers and Rears." So... they wouldn't accept it, so they finally talked him into making another sign, and Russ was getting pretty drunk and pretty unhappy. So he came back, and he said, I remade this sign, but he said, "I want my money. I'm broke, and I need some dough to get some more booze, so this is the last one I'm going to paint." So he put on it, "Nuts and Bolts." So that's our good friend Russ Jennings, and you know, I've learned to love the big jerk like a brother. He's caused me a lot of misery in years past by driving over a lot of mountain passes in blizzards trying to help him start a little group up in Granby. But he's sincere. He's very, I don't know, he's a perfectionist in my mind, because you've got to be perfect for us if you're working AA. We all have a lot of fun in this AA program. If you make it fun. Without fun, I don't believe I could stay in it. But there's also a lot of hard work and a lot of misery connected with it. We all know that alcoholism isn't very pretty. And I'm going to go into that phrase of it, and I'm not going to tell you too much about my story. I'll identify myself as an alcoholic. A few years ago, during the Depression years, things was pretty tough. And I got married to a wonderful girl. And I drank like everybody else. And we had quite a tough struggle. And finally, I went on the police department in Denver. And being what I was at that time, I was, I guess, a playboy. I don't know what else you'd call it. I finally got on the morals. If you ever go in a police department, they're going to morals bureau. Because it's pretty rough. And you see all the things that you shouldn't see. And I worked with all the people you shouldn't work with. And I became one of them people. I have seen a lot of misery. I've seen men, and I couldn't believe it. I've seen men that were tops in their profession. They were men that were maybe the pillar in their community. And I watched them same men through alcoholism race the street where everybody is equal. And that's Skid Row. I've talked to a lot of men on Skid Row, and none of them men ever thought they'd ever get off of it. Never thought they'd ever get off of it. Them men weren't born on that street. All of them men and women at one time were loved by someone. They wanted someone, just like we want someone. But they start running, and they all aren't as fortunate as us that have our mates left through a lot of faith that something, sometime, somewhere will bring us back to them. As alcoholics, we know the harm we cause our loved ones and the people that care for us. But I don't believe there is an alcoholic anywhere that ever meant to hurt anybody. And I don't believe they ever did sober. I continued on this police department and on this moral bureau for a long time, and finally, through my drinking, I got demoted. But that made me resentful. So, my drinking pattern upped itself. They put me in a uniform and they put me walking a beat right in the heart of Skid Row. And I used to watch them folks. They used to put them in jail when I should be in jail myself. But that's just the way it was. But there's nothing we can do, or no other officer can do. That man or woman goes to sleep in a person's doorway, and we, in police work, know that the first thing of a police officer is to save lives. And that's the first thought of a police officer when you pick an alcoholic or a drunk off the sidewalk, is saving his life. It got to the point where my superiors cautioned me a lot of times. My wife had to take me to work. She had to come and get me. They couldn't let me alone. I went into institutions. I went to psychiatrists. I went to rabbis. I went to priests. I went to everything. Nothing seemed to help. The same pattern as every other alcoholic that I've ever spoken to. Finally, it got so bad that they told my wife that if she couldn't make me quit drinking, that they would have to discharge me. They voluntarily, I went into one of the institutions, you know, them queer houses out there, and I thought it was like any other hospital, so I checked in. And I was drunk. So I said, I'd like to have a private room. And I got there about dinner time. So a great big burly attendant, he took me by the arm and led me into a bathroom and said, take your clothes off, take a bath. So I did. And marched me around to the dining room and handed me a spoon. And I said to the guy, I'm not nuts. I can eat with a knife and fork. He said, well, I hear you're not going to. So I got resentful, and I had a lot of friends, an awful lot of friends. And some way, I managed to get a lot of liquor into that place, into this nut house. And I was such a pest and such a nuisance that after 30 days, they asked me to leave. I kept everybody in the place drunk in this certain ward. So my dear wife came to get me, and naturally I had a little bag and had a lot of labels on with your name and so forth and so on. They let me out in the foyer, and I said, now look, I got to go see somebody. And three weeks later, she found me. But I didn't get fired because I always had a very good alibi. I had amnesia. You know, that's a pretty good alibi for an alcoholic. So I went along, and by the grace of God, a couple of years later, I got injured. And I got retired. And then I went into a retirement. I don't believe that there has to be one day in 30 that I ever came back. Now, this isn't very nice, and I'm not very proud of it. But I had to do that to bring us to the point where I'm going to tell you. I went to work for the government as a chief protection officer for a medical institution out there. For 3 years, I was drunk. 3 solid years. I believe I maybe brought in 3 years, $55 or $60 into my home. I never was home. She never knew where I was. She didn't know any time the phone rang or anybody to knock at the door. So maybe it'd be the morgue. Maybe it'd be a police officer. And finally, she got to the point where there was nothing left for her to do but go her way and I go mine. But we lived together as man and wife for a long, long time. And finally, I hit that level where all men are equal, Skid Row. And it isn't very nice. So, finally, after a 3 week drunk one Sunday morning, there was a little Greek in this Skid Row place. And he said to me, "You're ruining your life. Why don't you do something about it?" Now, this Greek couldn't even talk American. And I couldn't understand him very good. And I said, "What'll I do?" And he said, "I fix you up." So he went to the telephone. In a little while, a perfect stranger came in, and he called me by name. And he called me outside, and he said, "Do you want some help about your drinking problem?" Well, I was drunk, and I thought there was a gimmick, and I said, "Sure." So he took me up to the AA club. I was goofy. I didn't know where I was. He understood my condition, and I hadn't been home, so he took me home. He took me into the house, and he put me to bed, and it was all for me. And then he told my wife about AA. Of course, she was very skeptical because I'd never associated with anybody before that had been sober for so long, and she thought there was another angle to it. But he stayed with her for 5 hours, convincing her about AA. On Tuesday night, he came by after me, and he took me up to a little club, and I still didn't know what it was all about, and I thought I was with a bunch of Jehovah's. They were talking about, "I got a baby 3 months old, and I got a baby 6 months old." So I went along with them, and I didn't say very much. And every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday, that man was there, religiously, until I got a little bit of my thinking back. And then he started talking about that first step. Not until then, he didn't. And, of course, being what I was, it took a long time for him to convince me. But I was staying sober. I was getting along fairly well at home. Maybe my wife would say to my daughter, "You tell Daddy this," and then I'd send the message back to her. See, we got that far. Finally, she started going to the meetings with me. And then we had something in common. The groups were very small. She took an active part. I took an active part. It was a dirty, little, filthy hole, and I love it. And I wish it was there right now. The cockroaches, you could put a saddle on them and ride them across this prairie. But it was where I found my sobriety, and a lot of people found theirs. And I used to watch them people when they came up the stairs, the wives of the alcoholic and the children. Them people had lost everything. They had nothing left. They had lost their self-respect. The woman was full of fear. The child was full of fear. And after a certain length of time, you could see that serenity creep into that white face and into the alcoholic face. Finally, we grew pretty big, and we moved into a big palace, which most of you know where it's at. And we got away from the closeness of the person that needed the help that I liked to give. So we inaugurated an industrial group, or a 12-step house down the lower end of the skid. And you know, If you people have never been in a flop house, full of fear, frustrated, scared, you didn't know what was going to happen to you, you've been kicked around, nobody wanted you, you were afraid to go on the street because you'd be picked up by the law, you would be taken to a police court, you'd be given a sentence in the county jail, you went in there, as you come out, you were more resentful and you never had anything different. The same dirty clothes was handed back to you, the rear of your bitches out, your shirt was dirty. You only had one other place to go, and that was back to the alley where they welcomed me. If somebody had a 39 cents for a jug, or they had 15 cents, you could get 2 cents more. And the merry-go-round goes on and around and on. They, them men, and the women also down there, they have nothing. Nobody wants them but AA. And I know it's a tough thing to do. It's tough for a person to go down there because you feel inadequate. But remember one thing, that for the grace of God, it could be you, just like it was me. If it hadn't been for some person that didn't know me in AA, some very charitable gentleman came down to a skid row and got me, God knows where I'd been. And you know and I know that everybody on a skid row is an alcoholic. We also know, regardless of where you're at, that all alcoholics don't want to quit drinking. But on a skid row, we'll say 15% of them people are alcoholics. And there's a difference between an alcoholic and a drunk. An alcoholic has ambition. He wants to do something with his life. He wants to rise above that, but he doesn't know how. He can't get away from there. And that's the point I'm trying to bring out. We have, in the short years that this place has been down there, and every city of any size has a skid row. In them short years, we must have rehabilitated at least 350 people. I mean good, solid citizens. People have gone back to their families, gone back to their positions they held in life and in society in the years gone by. We have boxes of letters from mothers, fathers, wives, children. And then people, they can't thank us enough. We don't need thanks. Nobody owes us anything. We do not get a dime, not one nickel, from any source except the alcoholic that has recovered. We don't ask anybody for one crying dime. We take the men up there, like I say, they're confused. Most of them are dirty. Most of them are in shakes. Most of them have no self-respect. Financially, they're gone. Mentally, they're gone. Morally, they're gone. Spiritually, they're gone. They have nothing. No faith of any kind. Until maybe they walk up there the stairs and somebody gives them a pat on the back. Say, here's a razor, Joe. Be cleaned up. They'll give you a clean shirt. And sit down and have a cup of coffee. And we'll see what we can do about it. They don't ask you for nothing. All they want is a chance. Just like we were given a chance. We don't have any group, we don't have any politics, we don't have any nothing. All we have to offer is a way of life and the 12 steps and for unfortunate people. I know in my own heart that any alcoholic that's got right out and got back with his loved ones again, that if you just stop and think a minute, when a 12-step call comes in, it wouldn't make any difference to him what side of the track it came from. Because we're all here tonight for one reason. We are sick people. And position in life should not matter. Not one iota. When that call comes, we should gladly accept it. Because maybe the person that got the call on you has stuck it in his pocket and forgotten about it, where would you have been? You know, I've seen a lot of people, and I don't call them AA. They've got sobriety, maybe, but that's all they've got. Just sobriety. They don't know what happiness or contentment in this life is. They're still sick, and someday that sickness will reoccur. We have a program to follow, and we must follow it for our own sobriety, our own insurance, our own happiness. We're sick people. They tell us we're sick. And we're always going to be sick. Till the end of our day, they give us 12 steps to work on. And the last step is the most important step, and that's the reason they put it last. For our continued sobriety and happiness, we've got to work that 12th step. It doesn't say that you should go to a country club or a penthouse. It tells you to carry the message. It doesn't tell you where to carry it or how to carry it, but carry it. I've seen people that they call hopeless. Hopeless men and hopeless women. People that nobody wanted any part of. That are back in their respected positions in society and their homes through this little fellowship we call Alcoholics Anonymous, because some person wanted to do something for somebody else. And that's all it has to be. Somebody wanting to do something for somebody else. You know, I heard a saying one time, the best way to strengthen your heart is to bend down and pick somebody up. And I believe it. You can't tell what's inside of a man by looking on the outside. And another thing I say, that there isn't anybody hopeless. I've had that proven to me so many, many, many times. Back in 1945, I believe it was, there was a man, he's an electrical engineer. That man slipped 34 times in 2 years. And everybody said, "You're a damn fool, Jimmy, why don't you give up?" That man has been dry 7 years. He's a top engineer in our city. There was another fellow, he's a psychiatrist, a young fellow from St. Louis. We got him in an alley. Dirty, crummy, stinking. We took him. We took him up to our place. He'd lost his wife and two little children. He'd had an automobile accident while drunk, full of idiot juice, and killed all three of them. And he started to run. It took a long time to convince that man. But he's back in St. Louis. He's got his practice back. He's on a staff of a veterans hospital. We hear from him once a month. That man would have destroyed himself through alcohol if somebody hadn't cared. We have a mission in Denver called the Citizens Mission. It isn't any place where you have to go and do a nosedive to get anything. It's run by a group of businessmen, and it's also on the Red Feather list. I think the Red Feather, the community chest, gives the 25%. The rest of it is taken care of. All the expenditures, all the work is taken care of by the people that pass through that mission. On the average, they feed twice a day 28, 29, 3,000 people. In the evening, they house 350. They have a chapel. There's no religious sermons preached in this chapel. There's nothing but AA. Three times a week, the volunteers go down there and talk to these boys. It's like talking to the living dead. Sometime try it if you ever hit Denver. You face them people, and you feel inadequate. They have no emotion, no expressions on their faces whatsoever. You can't raise nothing out of them. And pretty soon through that audience, to pick up one guy, when you say something, maybe he'll straighten his shoulders up a little bit. And after this meeting, you ask some people if they'd like to come up to an AA meeting, an AA group. We get them from 50 to 100 to 150 at a time. We have nothing to offer them but AA. There's no gimmicks. We give them coffee, cigarettes, and somebody to try to talk to them. Individually, if we can. It's quite a deal. And out of that 150 men, maybe we'll get two. Just two. But that's something. That's more than anybody else can say. We got two. You know, we have 150 a day in the wintertime. Now just think of it. Them people are running. They're allowed 5 nights at this mission, whether it be summer or winter. They have nowhere to go. Nobody wants them people at all. The only people that want them, like I said, is AA and the policeman. The policeman will put them in jail. AA will try to do something with their life if they want to do it. We know that regardless how much you'd like to help anybody, if that person doesn't want to help himself, there's nothing we can do about it. But like all of us, maybe if we just inoculate him, we plant that seed, maybe he won't get his sobriety in Denver, he may go to Dallas and see Al Bashir. He may come here to Rio Doce and see Phil Fletcher. He may go anyplace. But when that seed is planted in him, he isn't happy that he's drinking anymore. We've had men that we talked to 2 years ago that would write us a year later, a year and a half later from New York City and tell us that the little seed that we planted maybe 6 months before had worked. And that's the miracle that we find in AA. When people say, well, I have nothing to say to a fellow, I don't talk his language, you're just kidding yourself. Because a drunk's a drunk wherever you go. And that drunk, as I say, never was on Skid Row all of his life. Maybe a month before that, he was your family physician, or somebody's attorney, or your public accountant, or your boss. So, when you get a call in the lower end of town, do it for your own conscience. Do it for yourself. Go down and try it sometime. Just go down and try it. You're going to be saving a life. And sometime that life may be yours. I know AA saved my life and also saved Clara's. Because I know for 20 years, I don't know how she did it. She had more tolerance, more faith than any person that I've ever met. I lied, I stole, I did anything for that almighty drink. You know, being an alcoholic and being an alcoholic policeman is pretty easy because Christ can really get all you want to drink. Don't cost you a dime. It makes it pretty tough. Hell, I brought liquor home and we never had nothing to eat in the house. But, to me, that I stole. I'd steal from her. And I can remember, and I'm not very proud of this, but being an alcoholic, you've got to be honest at least. I know it's been a long time ago and I was an elk. And I was very proud about being an elk, you know. So I was going through the chair. And she was going to the hospital for a serious goiter operation. So it was snowing out. So I told her, now don't you worry, I'm just going down and I'll be right back home. I'll be home in an hour. Well, it was cold, it was during prohibition. So I stopped the bootlegger to get one drink. You know how it goes. I woke up in Kansas City. She never got the operation, you know. But for 20 years, every year I promised to take her on a vacation. Every year, I promised faithfully, and every year I went on a vacation. You know, I went down to Skid Row with the boys in the alley. And I'd wake up in the flop house, and she would find me. She'd find all my equipment. She's done it not once, 1,000 times. I don't know how she did it. She'd go in the flop houses after me. She'd find me. I'd have my gun here, my belt there, my badge over here, my revolver some other place. And it was pitiful. But I didn't realize what I was doing. I mean, it's a poor excuse to say, well, you don't know what you're doing. Right now, it sounds kind of silly to me. But that's the truth. I really sincerely wanted to quit drinking. I didn't know how. I really didn't know how. I don't think I'm a stupid idiot, but I must have been. I must have been an idiot, because everything that I held dear to me, I lost, except my wife. And by the grace of God, I don't know how she stood. I really don't. I lost everything that I ever had. Nobody wanted any part of me. Nobody. I owed everybody everything I did. I was a mess, just a damn mess. That's all I can say, just a mess. And still, people were supposed to respect me. I demanded respect. I wore a blue uniform with a badge, and you know. But all the time, I knew up here, in my own mind, that I should be in there with them people. The people that I put in there. You know, when people talk about, well, they can have a tuxedo on, I watch these people. The people that have dough. You know, if you got money, you can do anything. You know that. I don't give a damn what it is. You can do it. And they respect you for it. But I watch these people come in into a bullpen on a Saturday night. Maybe you'd have 150 people in that bullpen. And here comes the guy in with a tuxedo all drunk, you know. And instead of asking the jailer or some trustee for a drink of water, he'd crawl on his hands and knees and drink out of the lavatory. But the next day, they'd respect that man. They'd say, well, it's $10 a cost, or and suspend it, Dr. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. You know? But if some poor bum come along there, they'd throw the book at him if he didn't have anything. And that's true. And it's true today. We know that. It isn't what you are or who you are. It's who you know. Whether you be an alcoholic or whether you be the president of the Grammy National Bank or whatever they call it. But in all sincerity, this AA program is my life. It's the only life that I can see right now. I have to work it. It's been good to me. I have to work it in its entirety. I can't work step one and go to step 12. It isn't being done. We all make mistakes, so when I make a mistake, I go back to step one. We have to do that. That's our life. That's everything in our whole world revolves around them 12 steps and AA. You've got to make it your life. An AA meeting, I anticipate an AA meeting before it ever happens. I know where I'll be on a Tuesday night. I know where I'm going to be on a Sunday afternoon. I know that. And I anticipate it. I anticipate being trouble, we'd all break our necks to help them right now. And that's the way it should be. That's the way it has to be. We have to cling ourselves together. We band together when we were drinking. If you was out with an elite and you found another drunk, and he was drinking like you, you two people would band together. That's a chance. You'd go on your way. You'd leave the rest of them there and go ahead and seek your own level. And that's the way in AA. We got to seek our level. And the old saying is, birds of a feather flock together. And when we're drunk, we flock together. And when we're sober, we flock together. We have to flock together. There's strength in numbers. We know that. And when Eileen was taken in steps, that's step number 5, a very important step in our life. You know, when it says God and one other person, be sure who that other person is. I advise any person coming into AA, if he has anything personal to tell anybody, go to a man with a cause, or go to a physician, or somebody that is not an alcoholic, really can trust, because we as alcoholics, we are sober today, but tomorrow we don't know. And I've seen a lot of people that should be alive today. They are dead on account of somebody who violates that confidence that they're sick. So when you take a new member and you start to go through the steps of them, be very cautious about that step number 5, because that's a very important step in my opinion. There are somebody that you know is not going to violate. We all have to talk to people. Now, when you can talk about your drunken escapade, it's all right, but when you got something personal, it's liable to affect somebody else. And God says, go to somebody that you know isn't going to repeat it. I know a couple in Denver, a lady and her husband, both alcoholics.
And they got a hold of a sponsor, and in 2 days he knew the life history. And the third day he got drunk, and everybody in Denver knew it on the fourth day. That lady is dead. And the husband is still drunk. Just because someone violated her confidence. It isn't any good. It's sad. You know, we have to be careful what we do in mixing up in our alcoholic life. We take people, they'll try to regulate your home life with your family. That isn't AA. We have no part of that. That's our own individual problem. I can't tell anybody what to do. I can only tell them what I did. I have no right to advise anybody to get a divorce, to leave your husband, or do this, or do that. It can't be done. I can tell them what I did about my alcoholic problem. If they can use some of it, fine. If they can't, fine. I know another time, I've been gone. Police department, if 5 days you're gone, you're automatically fired. So everybody was moving heaven and earth to find me. And I was one jump ahead of them. They had a fire department, the police department, the National Guard, they were looking for me because my friends didn't want to see me get fired. Not on account of me, on account of my wife. So they was moving everything, and she'd get a hold of some dude that I knew that I'd been up in his apartment. Him and I was drinking together for a couple of days. And he wouldn't tell her where I was. So finally she got him in the car, and we had a couple of Indian blankets in the back seat. You know, before they had seat covers. So he took her down to this joint, and he said he's up there. And he parked. He had to park, you know, conveniently by a hot tamale wagon. So she went in looking for me, and he couldn't find me. And pretty soon she came out. He said, "You had a pigtail?" She said, "Yeah, and tamale." And she said, "What happened to my blankets?" She said, "Hell, I traded for the tamale." You know, you talk about 12-stepping. There's a little fella in AA who came in off a skid row from Chicago. We call him Hooty Doody, and he had a jake leg, and he was a small guy. And we had a little fella up there about the side of Little Pop, you know Little Pop from Great Bend. And this little fella, he quite a gentleman, and he didn't like that kind of life. He didn't know what to do about it. And this fella, he was 12-stepping this little guy, and so he said, "Come on, I'll buy you some meat. I ain't got very much money. I only got 40 cents. So I said, "A Chinaman over here has got some pigtails and noodles. You can get a big dish for 15 cents. So they went over. So they were sitting there, and this little educated fella said, "Hey," he said, "you know, I like my meat higher up on the hog." And this guy said, "How much higher do you hell do you want it than the tail?" Well, that's the way with a lot of us alcoholics. We're never satisfied with our lot we have in our life. Before AA, we had nothing. Nothing. And we're always seeking something better. Materially, maybe. Maybe we put the material things before everything else. I don't know. But I can remember, and you can too, that if you had what you got now, you'd kiss the plunge thing. If you could be with your loved ones, you could be with your friends, just think of it. It took me 25 years to get my wife on a vacation. We've been on three now in 3 years. You see that, Reynolds? That's really something for me. But I don't know. I got contentment. I don't say I'm happy and I'm bursting with happiness all the time. I don't believe anybody is. But I'm contented. I've set a pattern for myself, and I try to go by that pattern, and things seem to work out for me. You know, a lot of people come into AA and get the thought in their mind, the power greater than ourselves, and that power is going to do everything. Just do everything. Wouldn't it be amazing that all you had to do is you come into AA, you get a little philosophy, and go home getting drunk with a good novel, and say, "Come on, fella, drop in my lap," and you started that, wouldn't you? You've got to do it yourself. You've got to do it. And the only way you're going to do it is working with other people. You've got to give something to yourself, and you've got to be sincere about it. It's got to be really important to you. In my opinion, a sobriety has to be above everything. Everything. You have to be put it above everything in your whole world. Because without sobriety, what do you got? You have nothing. Nothing. One thing. If you stop and take a look at what you had before and what you got now, at least you got three for a stop sign. That's something you didn't have a lot of time. You remember when you could smell bad? Well, you couldn't stand yourself. You know, that's another thing I hear so much about. Why when a man gets down, why can't he come to AA like the other people? Well, in the first place, the person has to be told a little something. In the second place, you know, there ain't a man in this room. If you had the rear out of your pants and a dirty shirt on and the sleeve of the shave and you threw up bad and your hair was blowing, there isn't a man in this room walking under the same circumstances. That's the reason it's so important to have a place for the people to come to. So very important. Because after all, you wouldn't do it, you can't expect anybody else to do it. It's the most important thing in a man's life is the first approach made to him in AA. We go up there, we don't talk about this Paul Gordon and ourselves or his boys. We talk to them about step number one. And then we try to get them on our way. We try to elevate them. We try to get them a job filled out. And I've seen men trip for a week, shaking. They couldn't light a cigarette, but they never refused a job of pearl diving. Shit, I couldn't do it, and I don't know how the hell they do it. But they do. They stay up there jumping. I've seen them jump with their whole body, just jumping. But they never ask you for nothing. We have nothing to give. If they get on their VTs and take them over to the hospital, they'll give them a shot of formaldehyde or a shot of vitamin B1, but they don't want them. So we take them back. That's all we got to do. We have no funds to go any further. But the man's sick there. And he's sick, and you know how sick he is. And you feel sorry. You wish you could do something. But you have 100 and 150. You can't discriminate. So you have to treat them all the same. They're alcoholics, just like you and I. And by the grace of God, you and I could be there. And I'd like to thank you people for accepting me the way you have. I don't have words big enough or adequate enough to thank you for the things you've done for me tonight. Thanks a lot.
Now you know why we love him. I've been accused of a lot of drunken things, been called a lot of drunken whatchamacallit, but that's the first time I ever knew I was a drunken sign bearer. It's a good story, anyway. Well, thanks, Jimmy, for a wonderful talk. We certainly enjoyed it.